All right. Welcome to Module 1 of the Bridge Micro Course on Qualitative Research and Analysis. I'm your instructor, Brenna Bray. I have a PhD in biomedical science and neuroscience and postdoctorate training in complementary and integrative health that really focused on qualitative research. This course has been developed for the Bridge T90 R90 Fellowship Postdoctoral Training Program. And its development has been supported by a grant from the National Centers for Complementary and Integrative Health, the NCCIH, and that's grant AT008924. In this module, we're going to provide an overview of qualitative research. So, we're going to talk about what qualitative research is, when qualitative designs are indicated, and we're going to focus really on understanding lived experiences. Developing and evaluating programs, interventions, or designs, giving context to quantitative findings, and answering questions like what is going on with the data or a phenomenon, why are these things occurring, and how are these processes occurring? When we talk about the use of qualitative research to support development or evaluation of programs, interventions, or designs, we're going to focus on needs assessments, process evaluations, and satisfaction estimates. These are just three types of kind of surveys or analyses that you might want to use in your research. We're going to have an exam at the end of this module. It will have 7 questions, so it'll be worth 14 points, 14% of your total grade. We're going to focus on section 1 of Barjo-Mitten Lenz's 2019 text, Practical Approaches for Applied Research and Program Evaluation for Helping Professionals. And that'll be section 1 in chapter 7 on understanding lived experiences. We're also going to pull a little bit from chapter 6 in this module, and we're going to pull specifically from section 3, types of survey designs, when we cover needs assessments, process evaluations, and satisfaction estimates. And then we'll also be pulling from LIMS 2024 text, What is Qualitative Research? And we'll focus specifically on pages 1 through 6. By the end of this course, you should be able to develop research questions that are consistent with qualitative methodology. You should be able to understand when qualitative methods might be appropriate for use in applied research and program evaluation endeavors. You should be able to articulate key findings of needs assessments, process evaluations, and satisfaction estimates, and identify strengths and limitations of qualitative designs. So, again, the quiz at the end of this module will include 7 questions. It'll be worth 14% of your overall grade, so it'll be worth 14 points. You'll need an 80% or greater to pass that quiz and this module, and you do have an unlimited number of attempts to take that quiz. All right, so what is qualitative research? When we think about research broadly, we can categorize research into two main types of research, quantitative and qualitative. So, quantitative research or quantitative methods really seek to understand different phenomena through numbers, right? So, our data would be numerical or categorical, whereas qualitative research seeks to understand experience and meaning through words or contextual content, so context. And here I've got a little schematic on the left. We can see, our quantitative research tends to be often more kind of binary and clear-cut. It's linear, whereas qualitative research can be very multifaceted. Qualitative research has several core characteristics. So, one, the focus is on understanding the meaning of participants' perspectives from participants, right? So, it's a very bottom-up process. And researchers tend to be the primary instrument that are used for data collection and analysis. Now, this contrasts quantitative research designs where we might be using biomedical data, we might be, assessing plasma levels, gut microbiome, gut microbes, et cetera. Here, the researchers are the instrument for data collection primarily. Qualitative research tends to be inductive rather than deductive. Oops. So, inductive, it's focused on building and expanding and understanding frameworks or building and expanding our understanding and frameworks. Whereas deductive research kind of has a more top-down process. So we might try to deduce data to test hypotheses. But in qualitative research, we're using inductive processes, which are more expansive. We're really trying to understand something and expand that understanding. And then qualitative research has depth. It's really, we get rich descriptions of context, participants, and data, as kind of demonstrated by this figure. So, a few other kind of differences between quantitative and qualitative research. When we talk about our research focus, quantitative research tends to focus more on quantity, so how much, how many, whereas qualitative research tend to focus on quality. So what's the nature or the essence of something? When we talk about philosophical roots, quantitative research tends to be rooted in positivism, logical empiricism, and realism, whereas qualitative research tends to be rooted more in phenomenology, symbolic interactionism, and constructivism. In terms of field elements or associated elements, excuse me, quantitative research tends to be experimental, empirical, and statistical, whereas qualitative research tends to focus on fieldwork, ethnography. It's more naturalistic, grounded, and constructivist. And then when we talk about methodological goals, quantitative research tends to focus on describing, predicting, mapping, or confirming data, and then really it focuses on hypothesis testing, so testing hypotheses. Whereas qualitative research focuses more on understanding, describing, discovering, making meaning. So it really focuses on generating hypotheses. And when we think about this, just this piece of hypothesis generating in qualitative research versus hypothesis testing in quantitative research, we can kind of start to see that one area or use of qualitative research is when we're just kind of getting a field off of its feet, or when we're starting to dig into a field, we want to understand things better and generate those hypotheses. A few more comparisons. Qualitative designs tend to be more flexible, evolving, emergent, whereas quantitative designs tend to be more structured and predetermined. When we're talking about sample sizes, quantitative research tends to often require power analyses. They require larger samples. Often sampling is random and representative. Whereas in qualitative research, we focus more on thematic saturation, so saturating themes. We tend to have smaller sample sizes. Our sampling tends to be non-random. Often it's more purposeful and even theoretical. In terms of data collection, quantitative research, we tend to use inanimate instruments, so non-living instruments, scales, tests, surveys, questionnaires, computers, really objective instruments. In qualitative research, as we address, usually the researcher is the primary instrument for data collection. So our data collection instruments tend to be things like interviews, observations, and documents. When we're talking about analyses, quantitative research tends to use deductive and statistical analyses, whereas qualitative research tends to use more inductive processes. They're more constant, and we use more kind of comparative methodology. The findings that quantitative research produces tend to be more precise and numerical, whereas the findings that qualitative research produces tend to be more comprehensive, holistic, expansive, and really rich and descriptive. So this is just a little screenshot from LIMS 2024 publication, What is Qualitative Research?, which provides an overview and guidelines. And it offers a few more comparisons here. So we're talking about focus, qualitative research, sorry, qualitative research tends to have focus on existence, not generalizability. When we think about nature, qualitative research tends to emphasize depth and richness of context and voice, so focusing on experiences and perspectives. It's fundamentally constructive or interpretive and explores the five W's, right? So what is going on here? Why are these processes or phenomenon occurring? When do they occur? Where do they occur? For whom do they occur? How do they occur? Really in the context of social phenomenon. It tends to promote reflexivity, and values subjectivity as a source of depth and insight. The nature that is not qualitative, it is not limited to quantifying occurrences or providing surface level explanations, and it's not merely anecdotal or based on unfounded subjective interpretations. And we'll really get into that when we talk about the qualitative analysis processes that we might use, so how we can really maintain and ensure validity of our work and make it kind of more objective. In terms of methodology, qualitative research really embraces openness and thus utilizes means such as open-ended questions, in-depth and focus group interviews, and participant observation. What it is not, it shuns narrowness and thus does not adhere strictly to numerical or statistical measures. We can include numerical and statistical measures into our qualitative research. In mixed method studies or even in qualitative studies, but it's usually not limited to those methods. Qualitative research is really committed to capturing complex, nuanced details of social behaviors and interactions. It captures a spectrum of human experiences and perspectives. It constructs reality by the researcher and/or the participants. So we're really working to build constructs. So, kind of moving from concepts to constructs to theories, and then, operationally defined definitions and testable theories. It thrives on adaptability and flexibility. And just taking a step back in that process of movement that I just mentioned, from a concept to a construct to a theory, and then developing operational definitions that we can test. When we get into that realm, then we tend to move more into deductive and quantitative processes. But in the qualitative piece, when we're moving from a concept to a construct, we're asking questions about how we might operationally define a phenomenon, things like this, that usually stays in the realm of qualitative work. Qualitative research does not provide a detached or purely objective account of social phenomenon. It is not a rigid or one-size-fits-all methodology. In terms of rigor, qualitative research demands systematic and rigorous approaches to data collection and analysis. It maintains rigor through systematic methodology, reflexive practices, and trustworthiness criteria that we'll get into in module five. Excuse me, module four. It's not less rigorous or valuable than quantitative research. And we'll really get into that when we get into, again, modules three and four, as well as module six. Qualitative research is suitable for exploring complex, content-rich phenomenon. It depends on research context, questions, and objectives. So, for example, understanding the motivations behind consumer behavior in a new market. Qualitative research is not universally applicable or appropriate for every research context, question, or objective. So, for example, it's not the best approach for determining the percent of a population holding a particular opinion, right? We would want to use quantitative methods for something like that. So, kind of reasons when we're getting into reasons for qualitative analysis broadly. Necessity, importance, relevance, and urgency are four primary reasons for qualitative work. So, if we have a focus area that addresses complex social phenomenon, the key points of qualitative research, it might explore complexities of human behaviors or interactions. It might make sense of complex social situations. It can prevent oversimplification and misinterpretation of social qualities. And it can provide a human-centered understanding of the world. Another focus area might focus on generating rich insights and human-centered understanding. A third focus area would focus on connecting research to real-world issues. That's kind of connected to relevance. And then a fourth focus area, focus on responding to social change. And usually those are more urgent kind of reasons or needs. So then coming back up here to key points, it can leverage methods like in-depth and focus group interviews, as well as participant observation. It can be useful for developing theories, informing policy, and making sure interventions are culturally sensitive or socially responsible. It's very applicable for real-world issues, especially when we're talking about uses in types of relevance or connecting research to real-world issues. It can be grounded in lived experiences, reflecting the complexities and responsive to the needs of the modern world. It can be relevant for social scientists, policymakers, stakeholders interested in understanding and making the world a better place. And this one we'll talk about a little bit more later on in this course, the role of qualitative research for social scientists and specifically policymakers and stakeholders. It addresses the needs for timely and relevant insights in rapid changing world, in a rapidly changing world, excuse me. Social phenomena are evolving due to political, economic, social, technological, environmental, and legal forces. So PESTEL, political, economic, social, technological, environmental, and legal forces. And we can use qualitative research to really keep up with those changes. And it contributes to decision making, interventions, or solutions, as well as overall well-being. So now we're going to go into some more kind of just broader categories of when qualitative designs are indicated. One, understanding experiences, processes, and meaning making. So when we want to make meaning or understand the meaning behind certain experiences or processes. Two, when we're wanting to develop or evaluate a program or an intervention or a design. And three, when we want to contextualize quantitative findings, so that understanding who, what, when, where, why, how. When we think about developing or evaluating programs or interventions or designs, we're going to really focus on needs assessments, process evaluations, or satisfaction estimates. So let's get into these three different types of assessments that we might use in qualitative research. We're going to start with needs assessments. Needs assessments can help us identify and understand gaps in research or knowledge, in clinical care, resources, or outcomes. They can help us determine what the important needs are of a certain population of individuals and how to address those needs. So, kind of what resources are required. They can be really important when understanding, or sorry, when a starting point is uncertain. So, when we're just getting into a field, we don't really know where to start. We're just thinking about starting developing a research program or an intervention. Needs assessments can be really helpful here to help us understand the needs of the people that we're wanting to serve. They can help us understand key needs and barriers. So, one aspect of needs assessment, we want to include input from a variety of sources and stakeholders when we're conducting needs assessments. So, we'll want to think to include patients, consumers, users, specific subpopulations. So, this might include children, elderly individuals. We'll want to include community members, as well as, especially when we're thinking about interventions, providers. Clinical and organizational staff members and administrators. And then also, we'll want to include health issuers, policymakers, and donors or funders. We also will want to consider what data sources might best align with our target audience and intended use. We might include data from surveys, records, focus groups, interviews, or Delphi panels. So, this would be a panel of kind of experts in the field. And when we're just starting a needs assessment, we'll want to identify who are the key stakeholders and what are their perceptions of needs. So there are four primary uses for needs assessments. We can use needs assessments to secure or advocate for resources, modify policy or advocate for policy change, improve specific services or interventions, and establish or strengthen partnerships. There are four main types of needs that we're going to want to focus on when we're preparing needs assessments. We'll talk about normative needs, so needs that are determined by experts, expressed needs, so needs that are noted in consumer requests for services or engagement in services. So if a service is engaged in a lot, we can maybe assume that there's a high need for that service. Felt needs that are expressed by consumers, and comparative needs that are seen or observed when comparing population information to services within an agency. And before we get into the next kind of needs, I just want to focus on this schematic here and just kind of outline the basic flow of a needs assessment. So we'll gather information, we'll analyze the evidence, we'll kind of start to brainstorm themes or identify contributing factors. We'll get to a root cause, and then we'll determine next steps for improvement. Next, we're going to talk about process evaluations. These are also called implementation evaluations. And I'm using this little schematic here from Flynn's 2018 text. And you can see they conducted an implementation evaluation and they focused on the quantity of their implementation, the quality of their implementation, and the experience of coordinated implementation. And when they did this in each of these three categories, they focused on a few different aspects. So when they focused on the quantity of their implementation, they focused on individual therapy attendance, so how many patients were attending each therapy session, and group skills attendance. When they focused on the quality of implementation, they focused on methods of treatment, DBT therapists' adherence to the model, and DBT participants' experience of the program. So they're focusing on implementation both from the provider and the patient experience. And then when they focused on the experience of coordinated implementation, they focused on the DBT therapist experience and the team leader's experience. So let's get into, we'll kind of take a step back and zoom out on process or implementation evaluations. We use these to assess if an implementation occurs as planned. These evaluations can be really formative. We might assess implementation fidelity, program activities, timelines, or certain numbers that might be reached. They often occur, we can use them during rollout processes, so they can enable troubleshooting, adjustment, and responsivity for long-term success, and they can help give context to outcome data. So as you can see, we might use process or implementation evaluations in program evaluation for, healthcare providers outside of research, but then inside of research as well, we really want to use them when we're developing interventions or research programs or intervention programs, not just to improve the quality of the intervention, but also to give context to the data that we might seek to later obtain. And here we've got a little schematic of planning, implementation, and evaluation. So we're going to select selection or topics and recipients. Preparation of materials, consultations, internal training, implementation, questionnaires or evaluation, and then data analysis, inspections, evaluation of other projects, and other kind of aspects. So that's kind of a cycle of process evaluation. And we use this in construction, right? When we're constructing buildings and when we're constructing programs. Why are program evaluations important or process evaluations important? We don't want to end up really missing the mark with what we're trying to create, right? So when we went over the schematic in the very beginning of talking about process evaluations, we kind of identified that that example research, sorry, publication that I pulled up, they kind of focused on the patient experience, the provider experience, and the experience of the administration staff. So when we are conducting user-focused process evaluations, so focusing on the user experience, the patient experience, we might be trying to understand how or why a program works or doesn't work. We might be trying to understand what keeps users engaged. We want to identify meaningful program or intervention aspects. What parts of a program do users value? We want to identify confusing or frustrating aspects. What aspects are confusing to patients, or what don't they value? And then we want to identify how are users' lives impacted by specific programs or interventions or phenomenon. When we talk about provider-focused evaluation, so focusing on the provider experience, again, we want to understand what is working and what's not working. We might make observations about participants' responses. So, what are providers observing about how their participants or their patients are responding to a certain intervention? And we want to identify obstacles or barriers, excuse me, to implementing programs as intended. So, there are a number of different aspects that we might want to consider when we're thinking about developing process or program evaluations. These considerations are kind of bulleted here. I'm going to go through them. So we might want to consider a service or program location. Is our location, are we in a rural location, an urban location? Are we trying to give an intervention online? We want to think about the number and sociodemographic background of folks who are served. And I'm going to touch back on this in a moment. We want to think about the quality of services, the actual events that occur while the services are being delivered, the amount of money the project is using. That could include direct and in-kind funding for services. So are providers offering their services as in-kind donations rather than for-pay donations? We want to think about staffing for services or programs, the number of activities and meetings that our program or intervention might include, as well as the number of training sessions that are going to be conducted. I'm from Minnesota, and in Minnesota, we have large refugee populations of Hmong and Somalian individuals. And so I've included a little figure here of the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, A Hmong Child, Her American Doctors, and the Collision of Two Cultures. This text talks about the implementation and integration of the Hmong refugee population in California, Minnesota, and other areas of the United States after the Vietnam War. And it talks about this implementation process and a lot of gaps and kind of failures that occurred in this implementation process, things that hadn't really been considered because this was done so abruptly. I'm not making a knock on that implementation process. I'm just using this as an example of really where implementation can be critically important. And lastly, we're going to talk about satisfaction surveys or satisfaction estimates. So, satisfaction data can be used to complement outcome data, but it doesn't replace outcome data. So, we might get our outcome data. Maybe we have an intervention that we're testing in the context of depression, and we want to find out, is this intervention effective in improving, Beck depression assessment survey scores? But we also want to understand, are the users satisfied with this intervention, right? How do they feel about engaging with it? Because oftentimes that's going to be a really key component in feasibility, for example. So satisfaction estimates can complement outcome data. They can enable patient or consumer-driven responses in care. They can really validate consumer experiences. And oftentimes they are required to assess patient quality assessment. So in some cases they're federally mandated, but even when not federally mandated, we can use them to assess patient quality. Some factors to include in satisfaction estimates might be interpersonal satisfaction. So a participant's satisfaction with the relational quality between the patient and the provider. Are they satisfied with their relationship with the provider? Administrative satisfaction, so satisfaction with scheduling, wait times, registration, things like that. And then technical or clinical satisfaction, so patient satisfaction with their clinical experience and progress towards a specific outcome. I've got a little visual here. So the NCCIH, the National Centers for Complementary and Integrative Health, really prioritizes understanding patient-provider relationships and how those improve treatment outcomes. So, if you go to the NCCIH website, which I provided a screenshot here, there's a little kind of blog about Emmeline Edwards' work on exploring patient-provider relationships to improve treatment outcomes. So, we've talked about two main uses for qualitative research: understanding experiences and developing or evaluating programs, interventions, and designs. I want to make a point that qualitative research can also be used to contextualize quantitative findings. So it can be used to support, contrast, or illuminate or understand different phenomenon or findings, add context and richness, illuminate specific takeaways, and just add kind of an overall human touch and enable us to connect to the data. So, for example, in the implementation process of refugee programs in the US for Hmong immigrants, This book really provides a lot of different examples of what didn't go well in this implementation, right? So we could talk about quantitative data. We could talk about what percentage of Hmong individuals are using the healthcare systems that we provide for them in the US. And these percentages were very, very low. And for the most part, these experiences were very poor. There were really not good experiences of Hmong individuals using the westernized healthcare systems. And one of the things that this book talks about is a lot of different barriers to those uses, right? So there were language barriers. Folks, Hmong refugees oftentimes did not speak English, especially initially in kind of the first generation of immigrants. And Western medical systems were not equipped with translators, right? So a provider might read discharge instructions to an individual in English and provide them with a written copy of those discharge instructions, also in English. But if these Hmong refugees don't speak English or they don't know how to read, those resources aren't particularly effective. So this book kind of highlights some of those examples. And that's a great example of where qualitative research can really help us understand what's going on here. Why aren't our processes working? Why aren't our users engaging in our processes? Why aren't we achieving the outcomes that we anticipated? Lastly, we're going to talk about different strengths and limitations of qualitative research. And we've got a nice schematic here from LIMS 2024 publication, What is Research? So, a few strengths of qualitative research, it can provide contextual relevance, so it can help us provide context to our quantitative data and really make it relevant for us. It can help provide in-depth insights, really holistic perspectives. Qualitative research is a great research approach to be used in complementary and integrative health interventions. It helps us take more holistic perspectives, right? So, are we, if we're developing or evaluating an intervention in the context of depression, we want to understand certainly, are we improving depression scores? But we also might want to take a more holistic look at what's going on. What's the user's experience with this intervention? Are there any other outcomes that we're observing, right? So qualitative research can be great for that. It can help us really raise participants' voices, and it can provide scope for reflexivity and flexibility. And then there are some shortcomings to qualitative research, not some, there are, just as there are for anything. So let's talk about what qualitative research is not. What are the shortcomings of qualitative research? Well, the generalizability is very limited. Usually we use small sample sizes, so we can't generalize our findings to a full population in the same way that we can when we have a fully powered, quantitative study. They're very qualitative research is very resource intensive. It takes a lot of time and engagement with the data. That may be, counterintuitive to some folks. We might think like, oh, well, the primary data collection source is the researcher, so they're kind of cost, low cost, but they do take a lot of time and engagement. So they are resource intensive. They require high research complexity. They're highly dependent on researcher knowledge and skill, and they can be susceptible to researcher bias. Now, in modules 3 and 4, we're going to talk about different methods and different kind of analytic approaches that we can use to mitigate biases, but they are usually a limitation that we need to be transparent about. So that's the end of this module 1. The next step of this module will be to take the quiz or exam at the end of the module. Again, you need an 80% or more to pass, but you get an unlimited number of attempts. All of the kind of questions in that exam pull from this module, so feel free to maybe have this open in another browser. And after that, we can move on to module 2.